came, I prodded. And exactly how non-coincidental is it? He took a step toward me, hands in his pockets. He was close enough and tall enough that I had to look up and see his face. If you join us, he said quietly, you'll be my partner, my asset, my companion. The one I follow into battle. The one who takes up arms to protect me. I don't take that responsibility lightly. Are you guarding me or making sure I meet your standards? Fair enough, he admitted. A little of both, probably. He nodded toward an alley between the buildings, then walked toward it. I followed. The moon was high enough to light the alley, although the view was hardly worth the light. Bricks, graffiti, empty wooden packing crates, and the steel skeleton of rusty fire escapes. You've made a name for yourself, Jonah said, turning to face me again. Arms crossed over his shirt. The angel and devil on his arm stared back at me, both with empty eyes, as if neither was pleased with the side they'd chosen. With a profile that high, humans may get a little too curious about the newest vamp celeb. And curiosity might be the nicest of their emotions. I didn't ask for the press, I pointed out. The story was a kind of favor. I heard you managed to hold your own at the shifter convocation. I assumed Luke had given the other guard captains a debriefing, so I nodded my agreement. And there are rumors Gabriel Keane likes you. That one I wouldn't confirm. Reviewing the basics of our security plan at the convocation was one thing. Luke had already talked to Jonah about that. But the things I'd heard from Gabriel were among Ethan, me, and the pack. Besides, if I was going to sell out Ethan, I wasn't going to do it without being a full-fledged guard member. If I was going to incite his rage, I was at least going to get a membership card out of it. Gabriel's a friendly guy, I finally said. Playing it close to the chest. I'm not a Red Guard. Yet. Jonah's tone was pretentious. I'd had plenty of pretentious today, so I half turned to leave, hitching a thumb over my shoulder. Unless you have something interesting to say, I'm going back to join my friends. You may not join, he said, surprise in his voice. You might actually say no. I let my silence stand in for an answer. I'm told no one's ever said no. I turned around again and smiled lightly. Then maybe I'll start a new tradition of thinking for myself instead of doing something just because everyone else has done it. That's obnoxious. I've had an obnoxious night. Look, I said, crossing my arms. I don't mean to be rude, but it's been a long night and a longer week. I'm not crazy about being stalked because someone I might work with in the future wanted to find out if I was as incompetent as he imagined. He didn't protest. Wasn't that flattering? Maybe you should look into requesting another partner, I said. You don't know me, and I don't know you. With all due respect, I'd rather have a partner who waits to judge me until after we've had 3 or 4 conversations. And I'd rather have a partner who takes her job seriously. I nearly snarled at him. Buddy, if you knew anything about me, you'd know just how seriously I take my job. We stood silently for a minute, the unspoken question hanging in the air. Was I going to be his partner? What are you going to do? He finally asked. I don't know, I answered quietly after a moment. I looked up at the lights of the city and thought about Ethan. I thought about what we'd done, what he'd wanted, what he could and couldn't offer me. I figured I had 2 options. 1, I could give Ethan the metaphorical finger and join the Red Guard. I'd be setting up a quick Katagun House exit, either when humans decided they'd had enough of Katagun vampires, or Selena decided it for them, or when Ethan found out and ripped the Katagun medal from my neck. 2, I could give Jonah the metaphorical finger by telling Noah, no thanks. I'd be committing to Katagun House, committing to Ethan. Wasn't that ironic? I wasn't really feeling either option. Both felt like ploys in a supernatural game, and I wasn't sure I was holding the right pieces. I certainly wasn't crazy about picking one or the other based on which vampire I wanted to piss off more. Especially given what was at stake. My life, my friends, the shape of my immortality. I'll call Jonah when I've made a decision, I finally told him. then turned and headed back toward the bar. For obvious reasons, I kept the conversation with Jonah to myself. I faked a smile back at Temple Bar, then faked a yawn so I could extricate myself from the crowd and head back to the house. Lindsay decided to stay, so I took a cab home, ready to spend the little rest of my evening in the thrall of the books. Say what you had to about Ethan, but the boy filled the library very, very well. Okay, arguably, that wasn't the only thing he filled out well, but let's stay on track. The library was a two-story space that occupied a chunk of the second floor toward the front of the house. The room itself was two stories tall and ringed by a balcony full of books. The balcony ringed by a red, wrought iron railing. A spiral staircase in the same iron led up to it. Three giant windows filled the room with light, and tidy rows of library tables filled the middle. Long story slightly shorter, it was lush, a book lover's dream. When I reached the second floor, I slipped inside the library's double doors, then glanced around, hands on my hips. I didn't have a research assignment per se, but I also didn't think I had the knowledge I needed to live and work hand in hand with shifters. Historical animosity or not, there had to be material on shifters in here. Unfortunately, as big and well-organized as the library was, it was still old-school about one thing. It had a card catalog. And not just any card catalog, but three massive oak cabinets with slender drawers, each containing thousands of alphabetized cards. I went to the S row, pulled out the appropriate drawer, then set it onto a slide-out shelf. There were lots of entries for books on shifters, from the Encyclopedia Tractus, the preeminent guide to shifter territories across the world, to A Life in Fur, One Man's Journey. I scribbled down the call numbers of a handful of nonfiction titles, minus the biographies and memoirs, then slid the drawer back into place. I bumped a hip against the slide-out shelf to fit it back into its slot, then scanned the slips of paper I'd collected to figure out what parts of the library the books might be in, and ran face-first into a brown-haired 20-something who scowled up at me with obvious irritation. Oh, God, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to... Surely you didn't think you were the only novitiate who used this room? Surely you didn't think the books just organized themselves? I blinked at the man, shortish, cute, bedeviled expression, who'd just cut me off mid-apology. No, of course not. Stuttering or not, I was actually being honest. The first time I'd seen the library, I'd assumed it had to have a librarian to keep things organized. I thought it weird, actually, that I hadn't seen him or her before. I guess this was him. The librarian seemed to relax a little at the answer, then ran a hand through his hair, which made it stand up on end. He wore jeans and a black polo shirt. Another vampire apparently exempt from Cadogan's all-black dress code. Of course not, he repeated. That would be incredibly naive. He motioned at the books behind him. There are tens of thousands of titles in this library, you know, not to mention that we're an official Canyon depository. He lifted his eyebrows as if waiting for my response, my odd response. Yeah, I said, that's, wow, tens of thousands of titles? And an official Canyon depository? Also very wow. He crossed his arms over his chest, his expression all skepticism. Are you just saying that, or are you really impressed? I scrunched up my face. How would you like me to answer that? One corner of his mouth quirked up. Cute, and you don't kiss ass. I can appreciate that. You're the new sentinel? The researcher? Former researcher, I said, holding out a hand. And you are? The librarian, he said, apparently not interested in offering a name. He also didn't take my hand. Instead, he waggled his fingers and bobbed his head at the papers in my hand. Give me your notes and we'll find out what you need. I did as I was told, then followed as he turned and headed toward the social sciences section. Funny, I thought, that most libraries probably stocked books about shapeshifters and were-creatures in the myths and fantasy section. But here, in the confines of this vampire-owned library, they were real. That meant the books were more akin to anthropology, or maybe zoology, than mythology. We walked to the back right corner of the room, the librarian's gaze on my notes as we moved. He didn't bother to read the signs on the ends of the shelves, apparently having memorized the locations of the volumes. "Vampires are talking," he began, as he turned into a narrow aisle between shelves. I followed him. Books of every shape and size, new and old, paper and leather-bound, stretching above us. "Talking about what?" "The convocation." He stopped in the middle of the aisle and turned to face one of the shelves, then glanced back at me. "Word is, they voted not to leave for Aurora and then attacked you." The stories of the convocation had traveled. Truth, unfortunately, hadn't. "They voted to stay and support us, not run away," I clarified. "The attack was against one of the pack leaders. They didn't attack me. I just helped defend." "Still," he said, "doesn't that just show what they're like? Fickle? And meeting to discuss their future in Chicago. Who'd have thought the day would come?" When he began to run a fingertip across the book's spines, I assumed the comment was rhetorical, but I still had a question. "Why are they called pretenders?" I asked. I'd heard Peter Spencer use the term against shifters as well. I knew it wasn't flattering, but I wasn't sure of its origin. The librarian pulled a long, slim, brown leather book from the shelves, then handed it over. It was actually a portfolio that held sketches of shifters in animal form. The usual suspects were there. Wolves, big cats, birds of prey. There were also a few more unusual options, including seals. Maybe that was the origin of the Silky myth. "Shifters pose as humans," he said. "They pretend to be humans. They mingle among them, even if they aren't really humans." I had to admit, the argument confused me. "But we aren't humans either, right?" "We are what we are. Predators. Humans plus a little genetic restructuring. We don't change forms to disguise ourselves." He took a step back, then gestured at his body with his hands. "This is me. This is us," he said, frustration in his voice, then turned back to the shelves from which he started plucking volumes. "Whenever humans have tried to take out supernaturals, the shifters have still pretended they were humans." I managed not to argue that vampires have been hiding in plain sight for centuries, pretending to be humans in order to avoid staking. Frankly, I didn't think he'd appreciate the comparison. This was the kind of prejudice that didn't bend to logic. "Is that what they did in the second clearing?" I wondered aloud as the librarian began stacking books in my arms. "Pretended to be humans and ignored that vampires were being killed?" "I think that's enough." "Don't you?" he asked darkly. I guess that explained the prejudice. I knew the wound caused by the shifter's failure to help vampires during the second clearing, to put themselves on the line to save vampires, was a deep one. And not just deep, but still jagged and unhealed, even more than a century later. I'd seen the animosity from the shifter side. They'd shown it clearly enough. Their urge to retreat sounded as if it was based on fear of what would come, so I still wasn't sure why so many shifters seemed so bitter about the past. But even as enlightened as Ethan imagined his vampires to be, the anger, the bitterness, were just as present in our camp as well. Even in this archive of learning and knowledge, it lingered. He finally stopped pulling books from the shelves, then glanced back at me. "This should be all you need," he said. "These will give you the basics." I nodded, working to keep my smile neutral, then watched as he walked around me and back into the main aisle. "I know what you think," he said when he reached it, glancing back, hands on his hips. His expression had turned stern, concern evident in the tightness around his eyes. "That I'm just as ignorant, or that I'm pissed about something that happened 100 years ago. His eyes suddenly flashed silver, and the hair at my neck stood on end as magic spread through our corner of the library, leaking as his emotions rose. "We are immortal, Sentinel. These were not harms done to our ancestors, to our forebears. They were harms done to us, our families, our lovers, our children, ourselves. With that, he walked away. A foot-high stack of books in my arms, I blinked after him for a moment, thinking not just about the anger in his voice, the pain over acts that had happened, but the fear, the worry that without vigilance, such things could happen again. And I thought of the passion I'd heard in Gabriel's voice, his desire to protect his pack members. I thought of the anger I'd once heard in Nick's voice, his desire to keep his family safe. I matched all that disdain and contention together, and I still wondered who was the bigger threat. Chapter 21, Just Dance. The next night dawned cool and clear. I pulled my anti-sun shutter and cracked my window. A welcome breeze was blowing through the city, clearing out a little of yesterday's humidity. I was scheduled to train with Ethan again, so I got up and headed over to the kitchen, grabbed some orange juice, blood, and a bacon-topped donut shellacked in maple frosting. Yes, you heard that correctly, bacon. And maple. In a donut. Sure, I wasn't thrilled about training again. I'd seen a lot of Ethan over the week, and I wouldn't have minded an evening to myself without political drama or relationship conflict, without swordplay or sidekicks. But what could I do? Because I'd sworn my oaths, camping out in my room, donut in hand, wasn't an option. So, after I'd scarfed down breakfast, I slipped into flip-flops and pulled on a track jacket, then headed down the hallway. I was about to take the stairs to the basement when I saw her. She stood on the landing between the first and second floors in a black suit, her arms crossed and one eyebrow arched. She was a master, made in her own master's image. I took the steps, but stopped a riser or two above the landing, my eyebrows arched. Waiting for me? You and Ethan have a unique relationship, Lacey said. We have a relationship? I don't play games, Merritt. All evidence to the contrary, but I forced myself to be polite. Respectfully, ma'am, I don't either. May I help you with something? I don't give up easily. He and I are perfect for each other. I almost snarked out a response, but held back. If she truly believed that, more power to her. Besides, he'd invited her here, so maybe he believed it too. You know what? I asked instead, moving past her. Good luck with that. She followed me down to the first floor. Ethan, timing as impeccable as always, picked that moment to begin the climb upstairs toward us, his suit jacket discarded, body hugged by lean dark trousers, a white button-down, and black tie. He must have been on his way up to change. His eyes widened at the sight of us together, as if he wasn't quite prepared for the meeting of old and slightly less old lovers. His own fault, since he'd thrown us together under one roof. How was your call? Lacey asked. And how are things in London? It was easy to read between the lines on that one. Dear Sentinel, your boss made a phone call to the GP he didn't tell you about. Guess you aren't in the loop about everything. Love, his bestest protege. Her second time at bat, she'd swung for the fence. I had to stifle down a growl. Not as helpful as I'd have liked, but so goes the GP, Ethan said. When he glanced at me, the line of worry had appeared between his eyes. I'll meet you in the sparring room momentarily. I nodded. Liege? He walked past me. Lacey, with me, please, he said, and she obediently followed. I glanced behind me and watched her trail after him like a puppy on a string as they took the stairs to the third floor. Something struck me as she followed him. Ethan was, and always would be, her master. And although I'd heard her disagree with him, raising concerns about my being a common soldier, there was something acquiescent even in her posture. She moved as if she were his property, as if there were nothing else she wanted more than to be at his side. Even though she had her own house, she wanted back in Cadogan. Lindsay had told me that Lacey was a very strong strat, so maybe part of the adoration was political. Maybe like him, she was worried about alliances, wanted to ensure her length to the fourth oldest house in the country. Or maybe it was something simpler. Maybe she just wanted him. Whatever the future had in store for me and Ethan, or me and not Ethan, as the case may have been, I made a vow then and there not to become one of those vampires. I vowed to stay my own person, to remember who I was, to think rationally about alliances and the people I might have allied with. If only I'd remembered those things a few nights ago, or when Mallory needed me. But what was done. A girl could only move forward. I was limbering up by practicing kicks when Ethan and Lacey made their appearances. He entered the sparring room from the main door. Lacey took her spot on the balcony, this time amongst a mass of vampires. The balcony was nearly full, from Lindsay and Luke, who must have been taking a break from their guarding duties, to Margot and Michelle and some of the other vampires I'd had drinks with. They waved at me, a fan club for a once reticent vampire. But I'd passed through reticence, and I'd become one of them, at least in part largely because I was a novitiate who'd been wronged by a master. Or two, if you counted Lacey. Or four, if you counted the former and current masters of Navarre. However regrettable, and however embarrassing, those wrongs had created a kind of bond between me and the other vampires of Cadogan House. A chance for me to get to know them without my rank between us. Silver lining? Maybe. Or maybe the world just worked in mysterious ways. Ethan walked toward me, his posture businesslike, his expression just shy of grim. "Prepare to fight," he said. I guess we're skipping the complicated teaching protocols and the greetings. "Liege," I said, and angled my body toward his, knees soft, elbows bent, prepared to strike or defend. He must have had aggression of his own to work out, as he immediately struck out with a punch-kick-punch combination that had me hurrying to defend myself. But I parried his punches and the kick, and then tried a shot myself, a crescent kick that he nevertheless fended off. We bounced around the mat for a bit, offering up testing jabs, but not yet committing to an actual punch. The crowd began to murmur and call out for action. I tried a sidekick, which he easily blocked. "You're hardly trying," he said, but he didn't stop moving. He bobbed around me before executing a perfect front kick that caught me right in the collarbone. I think he pulled the kick. It was still bone-jarring, but the full force of it would have cracked the bone in half. I rubbed the sore spot, anger beginning to boil my blood. Ethan kept bobbing and weaving. I kept trying to hit him. This, he seemed to think, was exactly the problem, that I was trying to do it instead of actually doing it. Here we were again, and he was running out of ways to motivate me with fear and anger. "I want you to use the skills you've learned," he said. "How to rely upon your senses, your instincts." I ducked to avoid a strike. "I'm trying, Sullivan. Try harder." Why did people always think demanding we try harder was going to help? I was trying as hard as I could. My inability to best him wasn't for lack of effort on my part. "Maybe you're just better than I am." He stopped cold, then moved so close to me that the bottom of his white gi pants brushed my legs. "You are sentinel of this house. It is not an issue of better than." His expression softened, and he looked at me with those deep green eyes. Instead of baiting me, he encouraged me. "I have seen you move, Merritt. I have seen you perform the katas with grace and speed, and I have seen you battle men twice your size. Your skill is not the problem. You can do this." I nodded and blew out a breath, and I tried not to look up at the balcony to check the reactions of the vampires who were watching me. I didn't want to see mine or Ethan's frustration echoed on their faces. Was that the problem? That I had an audience? It shouldn't have mattered. After all, I'd been a dancer. It wasn't as if I hadn't performed in front of a crowd before. And then I thought about the first time I'd challenged Ethan, and how proud he'd been of my skills as a newbie vamp. And I thought about what had been different then. Suddenly, insight. In that first fight, I danced. I looked at Ethan again. "Can I get some music?" He frowned. "Music? Please? Any preferences?" I let a smile slowly curl my lips. Something I can dance to. He nodded at someone behind me. After a moment, Rage Against the Machine began to echo through the sparring room. I took a moment, closing my eyes and letting the pound of Gorilla Radio loosen my limbs. I let my body adjust to its rhythm, and when the tension was gone and the world seemed to slow on its axis, I opened my eyes and looked at him, not as his lover or the vampire he'd made or his novitiate, but as a soldier in my own right. "Ready?" he asked. I nodded. "Begin," he said. And as if it were the simplest thing in the world, I attacked. I didn't think about it, didn't analyze it, didn't wonder how he might parry or defend. Instead, with the roaring bass line echoing through my chest, I struck out. I started with a high butterfly kick, and before he could defend, using the momentum I'd gained from the kick, I swept a high roundhouse at his face. He grunted and dropped down with his usual speed, then struck out with a roundhouse kick. But I'd seen that kick before. I dodged the move, flipping backward and landing with my body bladed, ready for the next round. "You'll have to be faster than that, Sullivan." The crowd came to its feet. We both hopped out of our kicks, balancing on the balls of our feet as we waited for our next openings. "That's better," he said. I winked at him. "Then you're gonna love this one." "Not if I move first," he said, then aimed a sidekick at my torso. But I spun around, one hand on the floor as I turned, then aimed a back kick at his head. I missed his head, but caught him on the shoulder. His inertia brought him down to his knees, but he hopped up quickly enough. The vampires in the balcony cheered appreciatively. Hands on my hips, I gave him an appraising glance. "That's better." He snorted with delight. Ethan kicked again, and this time I thought I'd try something a little different. I jumped backward into an exaggerated scissor-legged flip that took me 10 feet in the air and out of the range of his kicks. I landed again, and then the sparring really got started. We moved and torqued our bodies as if gravity made no difference at all, as if we were partners in a pas de deux. "Good," he called out, but there was a brilliant gleam in his eyes. That was when I used my best weapon. I looked at him and faked a sidekick. "I am but a common soldier," I said. He froze, his expression falling, and in that moment of discombobulation, I swiveled and offered up another butterfly kick. This time, I caught him square in the chest. He flew backward, then hit the ground with a thud. The room went silent, and then burst into raucous applause. Chest heaving, sweat dripping from the exertion, I walked over and stared down at him, not entirely sure about the protocol. What do you do when you've finally beaten your teacher at his own game? I decided to enjoy it. I let my mouth curl into a grin and arched an eyebrow at him. "Why, Sullivan, I think I just kicked your ass." His eyes were wide, emerald, and decidedly shocked. But even there on the ground, he smiled up at me with pride and a kind of boyish pleasure. When I'd stepped over his body, I offered him a hand. He took it, and I pulled him to his feet. "Always remember," he whispered to me, "that you are an uncommon soldier, whatever they say, and you are quite a thing to behold." I nodded, took the compliment, and glanced up at the crowd on the balcony. Lindsay and Catherine stood at the front, bodies pressed against the rail, both clapping along with the crowd. I grabbed the hems of an invisible skirt and curtsied, then held a hand in Ethan's direction. He chuckled, but made a gallant bow. "I believe we've had enough fun for today," he called up. "Back to work, vampires." There was grousing, but they headed for the exits, chatting with animation about what they'd seen. That was when it hit me. My inability to best him, the sparring wall I'd had to work through, was mental, emotional. It was about letting go of all my human preconceptions about fighting, about movement. It was about, as Catcher had once told me, understanding my vampire body's strange new relationship with gravity. It was about remembering, as Ethan had said, what free dance was like, forgetting about whether the moves were perfect, whether they looked good, or whether they were right, and remembering what it felt like to be truly in your body, to feel limbs move, hips sway, skin heat, heart pound, breath speed. I saw the covetous silvering of his eyes, and I knew that he'd realized the same thing I had. Lacey Sheridan wasn't going to be the only master vampire Ethan had made. And speaking of the last girl who'd gotten training from Ethan, I glanced up and oh so slowly shifted my gaze to the one who came before me. Lacey stared back at me, some new emotion in her eyes. It wasn't friendship, certainly. Lacey and I would never be friends, not with Ethan between us. But there was something akin to respect in her expression. It was the recognition that she'd met an enemy on the battlefield and found her equal to the challenge. The old me wouldn't have wanted the confrontation. But the new me liked the odds, even if I wasn't entirely sure the prize would be worth the fight. I nodded, acknowledging the battle, the challenge. She arched an eyebrow, no doubt in imitation of Ethan, perfected after 20 years of service in his house, then nodded back. Ethan leaned toward me. "Get dressed and changed," he whispered. "I'd like you to at least put in an appearance at her reception." I managed not to growl at him. Instead, I offered Lacey a polite smile, then trotted up the stairs to shower and climb back into my Katagon Black. Chapter 22. Knock Him Undead. I didn't expect trouble during the cocktail reception, but my run-in with Jonah taught me a valuable lesson about heading out without any weaponry. I'd been lucky that the vampire stalking me outside the bar hadn't been out to get me, but that certainly wasn't true for everyone. So as I climbed into my Katagon Black, I slipped a dagger into one of my boots. My hair went up, my Katagon medal went around my neck, and my beeper was clipped on. I was ready as I could be, at least physically. Sure, I'd oblige him. I'd clean up and walk downstairs, and I'd put in an appearance at a party held in honor of his former flame. But I wasn't going to do that without backup, at least in spirit. So I grabbed my phone from the bookshelf, took a seat on the edge of my bed, and dialed up Mallory. The first thing I heard was the clanking of pots and pans and a bevy of faraway curses before she managed to right the phone. "Oh God, stop, stop! Crap, crap, Merritt, are you there? Mal, are you okay? I'm, seriously, stop it, right now." The din immediately quieted. "What's going on over there?" "Science experiments. I have to learn how to work with a cat. They're familiar, you know, and she's into everything. She's been here like 4 hours and she thinks she owns my..." "Seriously, bad kitty. Stop that." "She thinks she owns my house. She is destroying my kitchen." "So, what's up with you? I saw your text about some drama at the convocation." "Violence broke out, but Gabriel's alive, and that's the most important thing." "I totally knew that apotrope would work, like a charm," she exclaimed, snorting through the phone. I rolled my eyes. "You did good, and I appreciate it, but I need a moment of best friend butt kissing." "What's he got you doing now?" Ah, she knew me so well. "He's hosting a cocktail party for Lacey Sheridan. He told me I had to put in an appearance. You know, I really dislike him in so many ways." That had occurred to me as well. "Well, let's do the checklist. Do you look fabulous?" "I'm wearing my suit." "Good enough. Are you going to follow him around at the party or kiss her ass?" "No plans for either." "Are you going to be your normally brilliant and funny self, reminding him by your very vivaciousness and joie de vivre how foolish he's being?" And that's why I loved this girl. I can certainly give it my best. That's all I can ask. Oh God, bad kitty. Merritt, I have to go. She's got my matches again. I'll call you later, okay? Good night, Mallory. Good night, Merritt. Knock him undead. Like I told her, I'd give it my best. Things were quiet when I emerged downstairs. I walk through the first floor hallway to the back patio. Ethan's door was open, his office dark, as were the other administrative offices I passed. I was halfway there, nearly to the kitchen, when I heard it. Music. Through the windows at the back of the house, I could see the glow of a fire in the backyard and the mass of vampires gathered around it. As quietly as I could, I opened the glass and iron back door and stepped outside. Black-clad vampires stood in rings, surrounding the haunting strain of music. There was a single voice, a woman, accompanied by a violin. Her voice was clear and sad, the violin raspy, weeping. It sounded like a dirge, a low, sweet song of loss or love, the kind I'd run across in my own medieval studies. The vampire's attention was rapt, the crowd silent, gazes on the musicians in the middle, whom I still couldn't see. They said music soothed the savage beast. I was a believer. I saw Luke's tousled curls in front of me. When I reached him, he looked over and smiled before turning back to the musicians. I could finally see them, Catherine and a male vampire I didn't know. He played the lonely fiddle. The clear but melancholy voice was hers. "It's a Civil War song," Luke whispered. Ethan asked them, Thomas and Catherine, to do a song tonight. This must be Catherine's brother, I realized. "It's beautiful," I told him. They sat beside each other on a low concrete bench. Catherine in a simple dress and sandals, Thomas in black pants and a button-down shirt. His eyes were closed, the violin tucked beneath his chin, his shoulders swaying as the song flowed from his strings. Catherine's eyes were open, but her gaze was unfocused, as if she watched invisible memories play out before her as she traveled the verses of the song. "She was changed in 1864, Luke whispered. "She and Thomas both. Her master changed them after Catherine lost her husband, Caleb, to the war. They'd only been married for a week." The song sounded autobiographical. Catherine sang for a young soldier's safe return, lamented the sound of gunfire across a valley, and lamented the soldier's death. She mourned the death of her true love. I'm not sure what made me look up, what made me search the crowd for Ethan, but I did. I saw Lacey first. Her expression was blank, emotionless. If she was touched by the song, by the lyrics, she didn't show it. He stood beside her, arms crossed, his gaze on me. We looked at each other over the vampires, over the music, his eyes catching the glow of the garden lights, centuries of history in his gaze. Centuries that had made him cold. And then his voice echoed through my head. "Merritt." He silently called my name, even as he stood beside her. "Liege," I answered back. His eyes glinted. "Don't call me that." "There is nothing else for me to call you. You are my employer. That is the deal we've struck." There was something helpless in his eyes now, but I wasn't going to fall for it again. I turned my gaze to the fire. It licked toward the sky, forked tongues of flame creating glowing shadows on the tinder. The tangy wood smoke rose, the fragrance almost intoxicating, hinting at a wildness that vampires in the middle of downtown Chicago, forbidden from the sun, couldn't otherwise touch. I stared at the fire until the song was over, then clapped along with the others as Catherine and Thomas shared a soft, sad smile. "Where did you head off to last night?" Luke asked as Catherine sipped from a cup and Thomas resituated his violin. I assumed he wasn't asking where I'd been, but where Lindsay had been. "Temple Bar. Lindsay thought it would be a good idea to get me out of the house." "And how are you holding up?" "If you meant in respect to the shifters, pretty good. If you meant personally, he invited his ex-girlfriend back to town. You can probably guess how I feel about that." Catherine and Thomas started again, this time a perkier song with an Irish cant. Luke and I stood together in silence, watching Catherine sing in a lilting Irish brogue. Thomas beside her, his fingers flying across the fiddle. "I really do think he cares about you, you know. He has a strange way of showing it. He's a vampire. That makes him strange. I glanced over at Luke. Even in the midst of supernatural drama, he usually had a quirky grin on his face. But this time, his expression was weary. And I wasn't sure if we were still talking about Ethan or Lindsay. Had something similar happened between them? If so, I could sympathize. It was hard to bear the burden of someone else's regret, and the contrition that apparently followed it. Are you and Lindsay okay? His expression hardened. Lindsay and I aren't. But that's status quo. Would you like to talk about it? The question was pretty girly, but the look I got back, eyes narrowed, stare flat, was all boy. No, Sentinel, I do not want to talk about it. Fair enough. Maybe, I suggested, if this is the product of immortality, we have to ask if the sacrifice is worth it. It does make one wonder, Luke said. Love was very definitely a bitch. Catherine and Thomas finished singing to raucous applause, the clapping eventually giving way to the soft sounds of cello music. Luke sighed. I'm going to mingle. You going to be okay here? Right as rain, I told him. Feel free. I watched him disappear into the vampires. It probably wasn't coincidence that I also saw Lindsay milling about in another part of the crowd. Catherine and Thomas are quite talented. I glanced behind me. Ethan stood there, expression blank, hands in his pockets. They're quite talented, he said again. I looked back at the crowd, wondering where his companion had gone. I found her on the other side of the formal garden, chatting with Malik. For the moment, the risk of drama diminished. Yes, they are. Gabriel called, he said. He confirmed that shifters who attacked were trying to make good on the hit and collect the payment. Who ordered the hit? They weren't told, and they apparently didn't ask. That's not exactly comforting. Is Gabe still sure the drama's over? Ethan nodded. He is all but convinced. That said, he is remarkably short-sighted for a man with gifts of prophecy. Or just not as neurotic as the fanged among him. And the ultimate culprit, I wondered. Who's to say? Tony may have been involved, but we still don't know whether he was the puppet master or just a puppet. And since we've been excused by Gabriel, that's how it will remain. We stood in silence for another moment. You're quiet this evening, he said. I pasted on a pleasant smile. It's been a long week. I'm just trying to relax. And I was trying to avoid more drama. He was quiet for 2 or 3 minutes, during which the two of us stood there together, black-clad vampires moving around us. I can tell something's bothering. We had sex and you bailed, I silently thought, and now your contrition is driving me crazy. I was just enjoying the music. I'm sorry. I clenched my eyes shut, emotion washing over me. I didn't want to do this again. I certainly didn't want his apologies. They only made me feel pitied. Please stop saying that. I wish. Your indecision isn't making this easier. And you think it's easy for me? Hey, kids, said a familiar voice in front of us. Lindsay approached, Lacey at her side. The traitor. Lovely party, Lindsay told Ethan, then looked at me. And how are you faring this evening? I'm good. And you? Eh, she said with a shrug. I'm not as popular as our dear Sentinel, of course. She put an arm around my shoulders. We took her to Temple Bar last night, and she was a hit. Oh, so that was the game, showing me off in front of Lacey. Ethan looked at me, his expression chill. I guess he wasn't impressed by my sudden popularity. Meet me in my office in 5 minutes. It took me a moment to adjust to the topic change, but I glanced between him and Lacey. There's no need for you to leave the party. We can talk later. Before I could finish, that eyebrow was arched. That was not a request. Without waiting for an answer, he walked away, a hand at Lacey's back to guide her along. Lindsay frowned. What was that about? I have no clue. Why do you think he wants me to meet him in his office? Well, he's either just figured out that you might win homecoming queen and he totally wanted that spot, or he wants to get down on one knee and apologize profusely for being an ass. We looked at each other. She grinned. So, since that second part is damned unlikely, are you interested in the homecoming queen bit? Will there be a tiara? What's a homecoming queen without one? She put her hands on my arms. Do me one favor. Whatever he says about your relationship or your training or Lacey, don't play bashful. Don't play humble. You've been busting your ass this week, and you've been making him look good. You've earned that bravado. Promise? I promised. I waited for 15 minutes. 15 minutes during which I forced myself to scan the books and trophies on his shelves and tried to avoid wondering what or who had kept him. I was leaning back against the conference table in his office when he walked in. He didn't look up, but shut the doors behind him and moved to his desk. He shuffled papers for a moment before bracing his hand on the edges of the desktop. We'll need to find a new physical challenge for you in order to ensure your training is sufficient to allow you to progress. Okay, maybe he really did want to talk about training. Okay, this is also a good time for us to keep communication open with Gabriel. If the packs aren't leaving, that means they're here. We should think about rules of engagement in case any more of them aren't happy with that decision. That seems appropriate. He finally looked at me, his eyes clouded. Enough of the game, Merritt. Enough with yes, Liege, and no, Liege. Quit rubber stamping everything I say. You were more valuable when you were arguing with me. For once, I hadn't been playing at acquiescence. I really did think it was appropriate. But his tone begged a response, and I was finally fed up with his back and forth. I was more valuable? I'm not an antique. Nor am I a toy or a weapon for you to manipulate. I'm not playing with you, Sentinel. I lifted my eyebrows. I was only Sentinel when he was pissed. And I'm not playing with you, Sullivan. We glared at each other for a moment, the room thick with unspoken words. The conversations we'd been avoiding. Watch it. No, I said, and his eyes widened. Ethan Sullivan, I imagined, wasn't used to his employees disobeying him. The only thing you ever want from me, I told him, is for me to be something I'm not. If I argue, you complain I'm not being obedient. If I'm polite, you complain I'm rubber stamping what you say. I can't keep playing this game with you, this constant back and forth. You know it's not that simple. It is that simple, Ethan. Take me as I am or let me go. He shook his head. I can't have you. Yes, you could have. You did. And then you changed your mind. I thought of Lacey, of the photograph I'd seen, of his having had a relationship with her despite his strategic considerations. Maybe that was what bothered me the most. What made me different? What did I lack? Why her, but not me? Was I not tempting enough? I asked him. Not classy enough? I didn't expect him to answer, but he did, and that was almost worse. There's nothing wrong with you. He stood up and slipped his hands into his pockets. I met his gaze and saw the green fire in his eyes. You're perfect, beautiful, intelligent, intractable, in kind of a attractive way. Headstrong, but a good strategist, an amazing fighter. But that's not good enough. It's too much. You think I haven't thought about what it might be like to return to my rooms at the end of the night and find you there? To find you in my bed, to have your body and your laugh and your mind? To look across the room and know that you were mine, that I'd claimed you? Me. He drummed a finger against his chest. Me, Ethan Sullivan. Not the head of Cadogan House, not the 400-year-old vampire. And not the child of Baltazar or the novitiate of Peter Cadogan. Me. Just you and me. He moistened his lips and shook his head. I don't have that luxury, Merritt. I'm the master of this house. the master of hundreds of vampires I've sworn to protect. I'm one of your vampires, I reminded him. He sighed and rubbed a hand across his forehead. You are my greatest strength. You are my biggest weakness. You called Lacey here. She's not a weakness? He seemed startled. Lacey? You two have a relationship, right? His expression softened. Merritt, Lacey is here for an evaluation. We've been, in my limited free time, reviewing the financial status of her house. This trip was scheduled 6 months ago. I didn't invite her here for a relationship. Everyone thought... He gave me a sardonic look. You should know better than to regard the rumors that swirl around this house as fact. I looked down, sufficiently reprimanded and silently thankful. But that didn't change the bigger issue. I told you that you had one chance, and you decided we were better off as colleagues. I can't play the game of wondering each and every day where I stand. I'm your employee, your subordinate, and it's time we acted like it. So I'm asking you not to bring it up again. Not to bring us up again. Not to remind me with a word or a glance how conflicted you are. I can't help that I'm conflicted. And I can't help you with being conflicted. You made your choice, Ethan. And we can't keep having this conversation over and over and over again. Do we or don't we? Do we or don't we? How are we supposed to work together like that? He asked the better question. How are we not supposed to work together? We stood there quietly for a moment. If that's all you wanted, I said, I'm going back outside. I walked toward the door, but he finally stopped me in a word. Caroline. I squeezed my eyes shut and clenched my hands into fists. I was eager to resist him, but he was my master, and he called my name. And that alone was enough to halt my march to the door. Unfair, I told him. Unfair and too late. Maybe if I had more time. Ethan, I don't think there's enough time in the world. What did I tell you about the Breckenridges, Merritt? Never burn bridges, I recited back to him and turned around, knowing where he was going. Before you accuse me of that, Ethan, recall that you're the one who walked away. I'm only complying with your request. We'll forget it happened, we'll work together, and we will do everything in our power to protect the house, and that will be the extent of it. I stopped before walking into the hallway, unable to take that final step without glancing back at him. When I looked back, there was an ache in his expression. But I'd given him my best shot, and I wasn't up for sympathizing with the man who refused to reach for what he wanted. If that's all, I asked. He finally dropped his gaze. Good night, Sentinel. I nodded and left. I walked through the first floor of the house, and I didn't stop at the front door. I took the sidewalk to the gate and nodded to the guards, then scanned the street to the left and right, checking the road for paparazzi. They were obediently clustered at their designated cordon at the corner to the right. An easy call, I headed left. I crossed my arms over my chest, head down as I walked. I knew Ethan would do this. It was the way he operated. One step forward, two steps back. Rinse and repeat. He'd make a move toward intimacy, then pull back. Then he would regret pulling back, and the cycle would start again. It's not that he didn't want me. He'd made that clear. But each time he let himself be human, the strategy chunk of his brain powered on, and he retreated back to coldness. He had his reasons, and I could respect him enough not to imagine they didn't matter. But that didn't mean I agreed with him, or that I thought his reasons, his excuses, were good ones. I frowned at the sidewalk, feet moving beneath me, even though I'd hardly paid attention to the motion. We were going to have to work together, that was clear. I had to adapt. I'd adapted to being a vampire, and I was going to have to adapt to Ethan. I looked up as a limo pulled up to the street. It was long, black, curvy, sleek, undoubtedly expensive. The back passenger side window rolled down. Adam Keene looked back at me from the back seat, boredom in his expression. Adam? Gabe wants to meet with you at the bar. I blinked, confused. Gabe? He wants to meet with me? Adam rolled his eyes sympathetically. You know how he is. Give me what I want, when I want it. Which usually means immediately. Probably not unlike a master vampire. Why me? Why not Ethan? Adam made a little snort, then looked down at the phone in his hand. Mine is not to question why, he muttered, then flipped the phone screen toward me. Get kitten, read a text message from Gabriel. Okay, so the request was legit, but that didn't mean getting into a limo with Adam was the right move. I hesitated, glancing back at the gate, light from the house spilling onto the sidewalk. If I went, I figured I'd get a lecture from Ethan about leaving the house to talk to Gabe without permission, and without his oversight. On the other hand, if I didn't go, I'd probably had a lecture in store about not being a team player and jumping when an apex asked me to jump. And then I'd still have to hightail it to the bar, and not in the back of a swank limousine. Besides, I had my dagger and beeper. Ethan could find me if he needed to. Move over, I growled, then opened the door and climbed inside, pulling the door shut behind me. Start me off at the Shirley Temple, I told him, nodding toward the bar on one side of the limo, and we'll see how far we get. The limo stopped in front of Little Red. The street was empty of bikes, and the plywood was still over the window. The closed sign still hung from the door. The driver got out and opened the back door, his face flat and emotionless. I threw out a thanks, then glanced back when Adam made no move to exit. He stayed in his seat, thumbs clicking at the keys on his phone. When he realized I'd paused, he looked up at me and grinned. It's not me he wanted to see, he said, dimples at the corner of his mouth. I'll have Mr. Brown here circle the block a couple of times and give you 2 a minute, and join you when I'm done. He held up the phone in explanation. I need to finish this. Your pitch, I said, then maneuvered out the door. Hey, kitten, he said before I closed the door behind me. I glanced back. Have fun in there. The window lifted again, and the limousine pulled back onto the street, then took the first right around the block. I walked toward the door. Chapter 23, Pack of Lies. I gave the room a 360-degree perusal. The bar was empty of patrons, and Berna was nowhere in sight. But people or not, the air was thick with magic. It also smelled of fresh blood and bruises, my palate tingling at the possibility of an early lunch. But this wasn't blood to be sipped. It was blood already spilled. Hank Williams crooned softly through the jukebox, warbling out a haunting song about whip poor wills and loneliness. The jukebox suddenly hiccuped, and the song skipped, stopped, and then picked up again. I walked to the bar, where the scent of blood was stronger, and gingerly touched my fingertips to a spot on the wood. I pulled back fingers, wet with blood. Oh, this is not good, I murmured, wiping my hands on my pants and scanning the room for signs of the struggle that put it there. A low moan suddenly echoed from the back room. It was a sound of pain, maybe with some despair thrown in. The hair on my neck stood on end. Blood on the bar and moaning in the back room. Something was very, very wrong. I glanced back at the door, wishing I'd asked Adam to stay and escort me back into the bar. What the hell had happened while he'd been on the way to pick me up? And so much for Gabriel's theory that Conpac put an end to shifter drama. I let out a curse and thought about my options. Option one, I could wait for Adam to return, but that left me in the bar, with God only knew what on the other side of the door. Option two, I could make a move of my own. That, of course, risked injury and Ethan's wrath. But someone was injured in there. I couldn't very well just stand by and wait for them to die. I lifted the hem of my pants, pulled the dagger from my boot, and adjusted it in my palm until the grip was perfect. I stood beside the bar for a few more seconds until I gathered up the courage to take a step. When I was ready, I blew out a breath and crept, weapon in hand, toward the door. When I reached the red leather, I put my hand on the door and pushed. The room was black, light spilling out around me as I stood in the doorway, one hand still on the leather. The smell of blood was strongest in here, along with something else. A tingle of emotion, of fear. Pack magic. As my eyes adjusted to the darkness, a shape emerged, a man on the floor, propped against the wall, face bloodied and bruised. One knee up, the other leg extended. His t-shirt was torn, his jeans shredded at the knees. Even though the tingle had felt familiar, it took my brain a moment to realize what I was seeing. Whom I was seeing. It was Nick. Oh my God! I ran to him, ignoring the pain as my knees hit the tile floor. I dropped the dagger and began scoping out cuts and bruises. Are you okay? He groaned in response. What happened to you? I asked. And more important, how? Nick was a shifter. He may not have been an apex, but I felt the wake of his magic. Knew he had power of his own. Who had the power to hurt Nick?
Gabriel,
Nick muttered, then coughed hoarsely.
It was Gabriel.
I blinked back confusion. Gabriel?
He thinks I...
Nick began,